Advices Radio Network.
Advices Radio is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The opinions of the host are not meant to be taken as medical advice. If you have a health concern, see a doctor immediately.
When it comes to the day of the contest, I'm his father. He comes to me for advices. So it's not that hard for me to give him the wrong advices.
Welcome back to Advices Radio. This is episode number 20. I'm here today with Alex Kickle, the prep coach. If you go to theprepcoach.com, you could check him out. Alex, thanks for being here on the show with me, man.
Yeah, no problem, man. It's my pleasure. Thanks for shooting me the Facebook message, getting me on here. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So for you guys out there, some of you probably already know Alex. We kind of run in some of the same circles. I see Alex over at Facebook and Project Bodybuilding. He's a very prolific poster. I see you posting up something new every day, whether it be on sodium manipulation or an example of one of your clients and you talking about something you've done with them. You definitely are an enthusiastic person, and I can tell that you love what you do. So that's why I wanted to have you on.
I'm sitting over here smiling as you're saying all this stuff. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, well, I mean it, man. And you're a cool guy. You seem humble, and you seem like you're doing a prolific amount of work too. So it's cool to have you here. One of the things that I've talked about before, being a coach myself, that we can understand how a compound or a diet method or a training method affects us and how that we can get a result from it. But then we also, as coaches, we have the ability to see a cross section of how that same thing can affect just a variety of different body types. And for that reason, we all have different experiences. And that's one of the reasons, like I said, I'd like to get you here to help answer some questions from the Advices Radio Q&A that we have set up over at the question box at advicesradio.com and get your opinions, because I'm sure that we're going to have some similar approaches. At the same time, I know some of them are going to be a little bit different.
And I think that's the best thing. I like how you said that, and it really is. I always try and tell people, it's like the way I like to do things. My co-host on my podcast, Austin Stout, the way we like to do things, because we're so similar, is you have your research and you have your anecdotal evidence, and you just combine them. It's not that hard. You see what should work on paper, you apply it. If it doesn't work, then you try something out of the box. And yeah, if that works, you really just follow whatever's working. There's really nothing set in stone.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I appreciate, because I've seen a lot of guys who live and die by science. And then I've seen the other side, where there's guys that don't want to embrace science at all and only go by the anecdotal stuff. I think it's interesting when you could find somebody who he's willing to embrace both. And from the conversations we've had, going back as far to a year plus ago, you and I discussed clenbuterol and how to apply that for fat loss. We both had a different take, but at the same time, we both respected one another's approach. And that's something that I think is really cool, because at the end of the day, put us head to head, given the obviously would have to be like the same person, if we had twins, completely identical twins that were starting at the same body fat and everything was genetically the same, that I could probably get my guy shredded using my approach, and I'm sure you could too. So it's cool that we can use our different methods to kind of get to the same thing.
I love that, man. And I know usually for me, some people misinterpret at least how I approach things, because I'm always posting up research studies. I just do that because I like it. I'm reading these things anyway, so I figured, I'll throw it up on Facebook if anyone else wants to read it,
Yeah. Yeah, what was that thing you posted recently? It was about the use of cinnamon as a glucose disposal agent.
Yeah. So GDA is glucose disposal agents. They're kind of like the hot topic right now. Everyone's always talking about them. I get at least a dozen or two emails about those every day.
Yeah.
And so I figured, this was a couple months back, I was like, I should just try a little experiment with my clients. So I reached out. I believe I had about 30 or 35 people that were actually willing to, get a glucometer, check their glucose levels, both fasted first thing in the morning, 60 minutes after meal, 90 minutes after meal, and 120 minutes after meal. And we did this for a fairly long period of time.
Okay.
We used cinnamon, we used chromium picolinate, and then we used, what was the third one? I think the third one was bitter melon. And about 95% of the people, after everything was said and done, all the numbers were on the table, about 95% of them responded better to cinnamon, meaning that their fed glucose numbers were dramatically lower than if they used chromium or if they used bitter melon. And I just thought it was interesting, and so I decided to make that Facebook post and see if that was kind of the same across the board. I mean, you know, cinnamon is one of the more basic GDAs, I guess I'll say. Yeah, everyone knows about it. They top their food with it, but no one ever actually, you know, checks the numbers. And so that's why I wanted to actually see how that played out. And the nice thing with all of this, too, was that I didn't just have the numbers. I kept track of all their pictures.
Nice.
And the people that responded better to the cinnamon actually got noticeably leaner within the, I believe it was a 2 or 3 month time frame that we tested everything over.
Interesting. And so what were your findings in that? How would you break down the results overall?
So first of all, keeping it in context, like we said, of making sure everyone knows to test it for yourself and see how you work and how your body responds to it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I would recommend everyone to get cinnamon and then one other GDA.
Okay.
And have the same meal. Okay. Take either cinnamon or we'll say chromium. So take your cinnamon before your meal, have your meal, and then check your glucose numbers 60, 90 to 120 minutes after that meal. Then have the same meal and repeat it only with chromium. What you want to look for is whichever one really has the lower glucose numbers. That means you're going to be controlling your blood sugar levels better. It's most likely going to mean you're favoring partitioning nutrients more into muscle cell compartments versus fat cell compartments.
Right.
And do that over time. Try a day of just cinnamon GDA usage. Again, obviously with a carbohydrate dense meal, so something like, you know, 40 grams of carbs, you'd maybe want to use 1 gram or 2 grams of cinnamon. And really just do that and play with the dosages, see what you find, see what works best for you. But that's really probably the best advice I would say. A lot of people, whenever, and this is if you're lean, so I'll say sub, you know, 10 or 12% body fat, which is the majority of people that I work with, since they're all competitors. But a lot of people will notice more of a pumping effect after your meals. Like I'm sure you've gotten it many times where you'll eat a meal, you'll start, you know, sometimes sweating, sometimes getting a pump, sometimes feel a little more vascular.
Sure.
That's usually a good sign that a GDA is working. But again, it'll obviously depend on the person.
Sure, sure. Yeah, okay. And you know what? I just want to mention too for all the listeners that you had mentioned your podcast. You also have a show of your own, and that's Beast Fitness Radio, correct?
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Yeah. So everybody out there, if you guys want to check the guys out, you can go over and hear them at that. I personally listen through iTunes. That's the easiest way for me to get a hold of my podcast. So yeah, it's cool to get together with you, man. I've got a good handful of questions here that people have sent over. And once again, for everybody out there who's listening, if you want to be a part of the show and ask some questions, I'm trying to do a Q&A about once a week. And for right now, you can submit your questions over at the Advices Radio website. That's advicesradio.com. Click on the question box. All questions are submitted anonymously. Coming up this week, we're actually going to change the format a little bit. We're going to have a small message board at the site, and that'll just allow us to have a little bit more interaction, you know, because I'm sure you've experienced this before, Alex, that there are times when you want to get a little bit more information from somebody when they ask a question, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe you wanted to know how tall they were, how old they were, you know, what their previous cycle experience was, if it had to do with drugs, for instance. You know, there's details. At the same time, you know, we don't want people writing in 3 paragraphs so it'll give us a chance to interact a little bit more. And also too, it'll give people a chance to do like a little bit of a follow-up. If they say, take some advice, they could write back and let us know, you know, what the results were they got. So starting out, this is a question that didn't quite make the cut last week, and I think it's going to be a pretty simple one here. I'll be curious to hear what you think about it. He says, I've heard that, Let's see. Have you heard of someone's belly button turning from an innie to an outie after gaining muscle on cycle? I've been eating properly 6 to 7 weeks ago after a small amount of time. My belly button started protruding, and the area is also sensitive. It sticks out even when I do crunches or leg presses. Actually, he says it sticks out even more when I do crunches or leg presses. He's wondering if this is bloat or what's going on, and if we can give him any advice. I mean, right out the gate, man, I'm kind of thinking hernia. What are you thinking?
So first of all, you know those little squishy handball things where you squeeze and like the eyes will pop out?
Oh, you're making my stomach hurt just thinking about that right now.
it was grossing me out. I mean, it has to be a hernia or some hernia related issue. In terms of, he said he was eating a lot, right?
Yeah, well, he said eating properly. You know, so basically it sounds like he's been dieting maybe and eating, you know, probably the bodybuilding lifestyle, but that's about as far as he goes. And he does say though that he's gained muscle. So I guess he's eating more than maintenance.
Okay. So the obvious hernia from, you know, heavy lifting, heavy training, a lot of people get a lot of hernias on squats or deadlifts because they're not bracing their core properly. So they'll be pushing out, in almost the wrong directions. That's probably the most common. In terms of the eating, then you had that too. He could have had a mild hernia from actually lifting. And then if he said he started eating properly, that means, you know, quote unquote, what everyone calls clean foods. So things that usually have a lot of fiber, if you're getting brown rice, broccoli, all that kind of stuff. If you're always bloating all the time, I've seen people where it'll make their hernia worse and it'll actually start pushing the fatty tissue out of their belly button. And it's not a good sight to see.
Oh, no, it's terrible. Have you ever experienced anything like this?
Oh, luckily, no. Knock on wood.
Yeah, I feel like I had gotten a minor femoral hernia once where, you know, your torso kind of meets your thigh. I could swear that it happened, that's what it was. It kind of seems to have healed itself. I'm just kind of crossing my fingers here, and I'm also... knocking on wood that was the case, but it doesn't seem to bother me anymore. And I don't feel it. I guess my suggestion to him would be to get into his doctor. Cause this is something, you know, once that lining rips, it's only going to get worse, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely not something you can just let go and fix. I mean, in your case that was lucky, but again, it since it's not your belly button, I mean, belly buttons, this actually going from inside of your body to outside of your body, that makes it even worse, because then you can open yourself up to infection. I mean, you can go down the list of issues that can arise.
Absolutely. And it's think of like a piece of paper that tears, you know, it's only going to continue tearing the more you move it around and mess with it. So I definitely, I think the earlier he deals with this, the better it will be. But you know what though, people feel like it's not super important because I could still get to the gym today and, you know, I could still do everything I need to do. I'll deal with it later if I have to. You know, I feel like this is one of those things where you just have to jump on it though and, you know, deal with it right now.
That's one of those things too. It's probably the best lesson I've ever learned is don't think about what's going to happen tomorrow. Think about what's going to happen a month from today, a year from today. I mean, if you let this go and then you're going to be out of the gym for 6 months or 12 months or a couple years, I mean, think about all of the, if you're worried about losing your gains, your progress, think about how much more it could be if you don't get taken care of now.
Absolutely, man. And long term, you know, you take a few weeks off the gym, say like it takes 6 weeks or even let's say extreme 8 weeks to recover. You're right, man. The progress that you can make going full throttle, it's going to come back versus training at what, 75% for the next, you know, for the rest of your career.
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I'll have people, and I'll do it with myself, and I'm sure you do it, where you have extended periods of breaks where you're almost kind of resetting your body, where things could be going great in your off season, or, you know, you just finished up a prep, and sometimes you need a couple weeks off to just let your body reset. You can only push for so long and so hard, and I mean, you may not want to do it, and it does suck, but just keep yourself busy and stay out of the gym for that time.
Yeah. So moving on here, the next guy is asking about a difference in muscle size between his right and left quad. He says, have you ever heard of one quad slash thigh being bigger than the other? This kind of gets confusing to me because he says, I've been out of the gym for nearly 5 months due to a wrist injury. But he's not training his legs either. My thought would be you should still be in there training your legs. But he says, I haven't measured it yet to confirm, but he says my right quad is noticeably smaller. I don't drive a manual car. I don't think that simple gas and brake would be enough to cause this. So this is something he's been thinking about a lot, you know?
Oh, man.
Yeah. I think this is common, but this is what I got you here for. I want to hear your thoughts on this one, man.
Yeah, so first of all, whoever submitted this question, don't worry, it is extremely common. It's definitely nothing where, you know, pushing your gas and brake, that's not going to cause any hypertrophy in one leg over the other. But if you can actually do one thing, take progress pictures of your quads, first of all, and then take progress pictures of your hamstrings from like a side chest shot and look at the insertions. At least from a quad aspect, what you're going to find is, depending on your insertions, it has the potential to make one leg look bigger than the other. Mm. I mean, if you have one quad, say your left quad that inserts closer to your knee and it kind of juts out a little bit more up at its insertion, then your right quad inserts a little bit higher up on your knee,
yeah,
then your left quad's going to look bigger because you have that small joint and then you just have a muscle that blows out from it. So I'd look at that first. Look at your hamstrings, because if those insertions are basically the same, which a lot of people have similar hamstring insertions, mm-hmm. Then it's not an overall width issue. Meaning, I don't know how he's measuring it. If he's measuring it just by eyesight, or if he's measuring it by tape measurers over his entire leg, because that could just mean that a hamstring's bigger than the other one as well.
True, that's very true.
What do you feel about this one?
I feel like you're really on to something. First of all, that the muscle insertions and attachments can really create an illusion, you know, and I see guys all the time that, you know, and I've even been victim to this myself, where I feel like, okay, you know, I look at like, let's say, a high quality pro 212 competitor on stage. And I think to myself, like, when I first started training, maybe I thought, oh, he's only 212 pounds. You know, I only need to gain 30 pounds and I'll look like that guy. A lot of times, though, it comes down to muscle shape. And, you know, like you're saying, that if you have a genetically superior muscle shape, it could create the illusion of a muscle that's, you know, much bigger and rounder. And that can cause, you know, kind of a difference. So sure, our bodies aren't 100% the same from left to right. You know, and I personally, I have a bicep, for instance. I have my left bicep, and you're looking at the picture right now on my
Mine's
on
exactly
my Skype.
The same, is it?
You know, my left bicep is rounder. It looks better, but if I put a tape measure on them, they are exactly the same.
Yep.
It just has to do with the way that the muscle's attached. So, you know, regardless, that's one possibility. I think another possibility would be, let's say he suffered an injury, you know, some type mm-hmm. of a low back problem, an SI problem, something that maybe he has favored the one side. You know, we do have a dominant leg, you know, just like we're left-handed or right-handed, we have a dominant left or right foot too. And you could figure that out a lot of times by, you know, when you are standing still, you know, what foot are you balancing on most? When you go to walk, which foot do you step with? And that, I mean, possibly could play a role in development if you say we're favoring one foot because of an injury, possibly due to the back or whatnot. But I don't think his wrist problem would be causing any type of a discrepancy between the muscles.
Yeah, I didn't really know what part that played in there. But, you know, the other thing too, if you want to test this out, you can just go get a deep tissue massage. Since you're focusing on your quads, have them actually focus all of their work on your lower body. So quads, glutes, hamstrings, calves, because a lot of people will have a tighter right calf than a left calf. Which
there you go.
Is that imbalance. And like you said, it's only going to radiate up your legs. And then you can turn a weaker leg into a stronger leg and a stronger leg into a weaker leg just because one side's tighter or not.
That's a great point. I once thought that one of my lats was smaller than the other, and it turned out that it was just bound and retracting, always kind of like in a spasmed state. And once I had some deep tissue done, it came out and it hung better. So it sometimes too, it's just a matter of, you know, we kind of continually put this muscle under tension through our training, and it could constantly be, you know, in some type of a contracted or spasm state. So I think that you're kind of touching on something right there that equally could be as valuable.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be painful. If, again, whoever submitted this question, if you do it, expect a lot of pain, because Scott, I mean, you've got massive calves. If you've ever had deep tissue work done, you know how painful that can be.
Oh, terrible. Yeah. It's bad. It's bad.
I had it done last week, mainly on calves and forearms.
Okay.
And a little bit of the rest of my body, but my calves and forearms were so tight. It was so painful.
Do you have issues with them, or was it specifically to try to evoke better growth?
Actually, yeah, trying to evoke better growth. I've been doing the trying to get deep tissue work done the day before I'll work a muscle group, depending on what I'm trying to cause localized growth in for that time period.
Yeah.
And calves and forearms, I mean, to me, no one can ever have big enough calves or big enough forearms.
Okay, yeah.
Those are two things I'm really trying to hammer. And I had it done, and it was just the amount of blood flow I got in the next day. My range of motion was improved.
Nice.
Yeah, and you have to assume, if all that's going on, that your partitioning and your nutrient delivery and your insulin sensitivity has to be better. And it was just, it was beyond painful if you get it done in your forearms and calves, especially if you're working at a computer all day. Your forearms get tighter than you actually realize.
Yeah, no, absolutely, man. Have you ever done ART?
Oh, yeah, sadly. that's the best stuff. I actually don't have anyone locally to do it. I had to do it when I was actually out of state at a friend's house. If someone had it, I would much prefer that over deep tissue, but gotta kind of work within the restraints that I have.
Sure. Yeah. One of my training partners and co-host for another radio show, VJ from Bodybuilding Nerds, he's a chiropractor and he's done ART. In fact, he was the one who worked on my lat. We brought it out just in time for a contest a couple years ago. I agree, man, that it literally brought tears to my eyes. Like, not like it made me sad and I wanted to cry cause it hurt so bad. Like, just involuntary tears were coming out of my eyes at one point.
Were you bruised the next day?
A little bit, not so bad on the lat. I've also had it done on my shoulder, and that ended up pretty bruised.
Yeah. The first time I got ART done, I drink a lot of water in general, but for whatever reason, the amount of pain that I had, because I had it done in my biceps on that day, the amount of pain just caused me to be sick the rest of the night. So I tried to just eat as much as I could on my meal plan and then just drink a little bit of water. And I woke up and the bruising was so substantial. Ooh. And I had to attribute that, obviously, because of the pain, but because I wasn't drinking enough water to actually get some of the metabolites and toxins out of there. So from here on out, I make sure to just chug water on that day. You really can't have enough water when you're getting ART done.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so for any of the listeners who aren't familiar, I know we have a lot of newer guys and gals that tune into the show. ART is an active release treatment or active release technique. And it's like a deep tissue massage, only even deeper. And they actually will move the body within the range, move the muscle while they're digging into it to kind of hit it at deeper angles and whatnot. It's painful. It feels like you're literally getting the muscle torn, I would say.
Yeah, I've never torn a muscle, again, knock on wood, but that's what I would think it would feel like.
Yeah. All right. So the next question here is about peptides. It says, what's the best time to use peptides, and what do you recommend / prefer? I guess in short, I'd like to go over a simple protocol with you guys, when to use certain compounds, and he also wonders whether diet plays a role, whether using carbs and sugar near the time of the time you take the peptides will have any type of negative effects on the growth or on the peptide itself. And also he wants to know what are favorite peptides and why. Alex, is this something that you get into? Or are you a peptide guy?
I'm kind of an everything guy.
Okay.
Like we were talking beforehand, I really don't have any I really don't have anything in this industry that I think of is the right way or the wrong way to do things. And luckily, the people that usually come to me and work with me are usually open to experimentation. So I absolutely love my clients for this, because we have a clear idea of moving forward of things to expect, what they're trying to achieve, and then we can just experiment along the way. So a lot of people give peptides a lot of crap online, and I'm not really sure why.
Yeah.
They're beyond effective. Have you ever used them yourself or with clients? Do you like them?
I do. I've had, you know what, my relationship with peptides has been up and down. There's times that I've liked them more than others. Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe earlier on I had gotten sucked into thinking that it was going to be better than it was. And maybe I've had some good experiences, and the experiences felt like they were going to be excellent. But then looking back at the results, I can't say that some of those experiments were worth justifying the cost. And sometimes just the time and the effort, man, some of that stuff, if you're going to be injecting it three times a day, that's a dedication right there.
It really is, and I know that's why a lot of people tend to favor the longer acting, even though, at least from a health standpoint, they have more potential to cause a lot more issues. A lot of people, I mean, if you work a 9-to-5 job, there's no way you're going to be doing, three shots or, you know, injecting every 3 or 4 hours
right
during your job. I mean, you just can't do that.
I did, actually, for a while.
How did you pull that off?
I worked in delivery. And I brought a lunch cooler to work, and you can always
dedication.
Yeah, you just bring it. You just need a cooler. That's all it takes.
There you go. Yeah, you would, because that is one thing with everyone out there. For a lot of these peptides, they're gonna need to stay cool. It's almost like an exogenous growth hormone, where you're gonna need to keep it in a refrigerator, or I'm sure like you had it on ice packs.
Right, exactly. What are the things? What are some of them that you find are really effective? Starting from the top.
So really effective. I would say by far the most effective has to be MK677, which is technically a peptide, secretagogue, SARM. Everyone calls it a lot of things.
Yes, they do.
it's really a growth hormone secretagogue, but I guess it's classified as a peptide. I mean, if you get good MK677, I've seen it blow away just about every other peptide on the market, especially for your money. That's probably my favorite. Now, the issue is it hasn't really been around long enough for us to know the long-term issues.
Yeah.
And in terms of a health side effect standpoint, I mean, we know a couple things, like it will cause insulin resistance after a while, like a lot of growth hormone products. It's going to help with overall lipolysis. It's going to help with overall hypertrophy. Obviously, increasing growth hormone levels, IGF levels. You are going to hold a fair amount of water, depending on who you are. That's actually why I like having a lot of people start off with 5 mg every, 2 to 3 days, and then slowly work that up until you get to a max dose of, about 25 mgs. There was one study, and I can't remember who it was from, but they were comparing 12.5 mgs to 25 mgs to 50 mgs.
Okay.
50 mgs basically showed nothing better than 25
interesting.
Or 12.5 in terms of IGF levels, growth hormone release, all that stuff. And 12.5 mgs when dosed every other day was almost as comparable to 25 mgs every day.
Interesting.
I think the numbers were, it wasn't that much. It was something like, 2 or 3 points higher in terms of IGF or growth hormone. So to me, if you can do that 12.5 mgs every other day, you're not only giving your pituitary a little bit of a break, because it is going to be active for 24 hours in your system, but you're going to save money. It's not going to be as harsh on your body. The water retention is going to be a lot more diminished.
Sure.
The only things that I've actually seen in terms of lipolysis with MK677, so the ability to initiate lipolysis, start fat loss, you needed a higher dosage, and since you're retaining water, it isn't until after you actually stop taking it that it's going to be effective. So I wouldn't really take it if you're trying to lean out. A lot of people will, but I mean, you're going to be so hungry. It's a lot of people end up cheating on their diet with that one. And like with a lot of these products, like so with MK677, for example, You're going to want to take it before bed, usually, just because it's going to make you so tired and you're going to have probably the best night of sleep ever. You'll want to take that with some kind of somatostatin inhibitor. If you look at how our pituitaries release growth hormone, they're also going to release something called somatostatin, which basically inhibits growth hormone. So if you're not taking a somatostatin inhibitor, you're not going to be reaping the full benefits because you don't really know when that's going to be released. So you could, say, take MK or one of these other peptides. And if you don't have one of these inhibitors, then the issue is you could not be getting the full benefits of your growth hormone and wasting money, wasting time. So in terms of somatostatin inhibitors with MK, I like doing 10 mgs of melatonin before bed, 5 or 10 mgs depending on the person. And then I would usually add EGCG to any peptide, okay, mainly because EGCG actually enhances the growth hormone receptor itself, so it'll make it a little more sensitive. So now you have the melatonin actually inhibiting somatostatin, so growth hormone's kind of free to, you know, roam around your body. And then you have EGCG actually sensitizing the receptor itself so that whenever the growth hormone actually gets to that receptor, it's going to be a little more effective. So it's kind of a, we'll say, a two-punch combo with that one.
That's a nice little package you've got there. I like that a lot. I found that for me, the sleep was amazing using MK. Even if I weren't just to achieve like an improved growth hormone level from it or an improved IGF from it, I believe that it could be beneficial just for its impact on sleep. That in itself, I feel like my recovery is better when I'm sleeping at that level.
Oh, I could not agree more. That's a good point to hit on, man.
Yeah, sometimes for me, that's kind of where I've looked at the benefits of some of these peptides. I think to myself, okay, I can get improved sleep from this. It doesn't necessarily increase my appetite dramatically, but something like a GHRP6 does. So my thought is with a GHRP6, okay, maybe I'll use this and I'll combine it with something else to get a stronger effect, but even if it's not going to affect my growth hormone levels enough to make a big difference in my progress, it is increasing my appetite each time I take it. So if I can improve how much food I'm eating, you know, then that in itself is certainly going to, you know, give me results. So that's kind of the way I've looked at a lot of the peptides that are available. What are your thoughts on a GHRP 2 and 6? And if you were to use those, what would you like to combine with it?
So if I was using either one of those, like you said, with the GHRP6, I would only use it for people that, you know, couldn't get down the food they were already eating. Yeah. If not, I would probably opt for, you know, GHRP2 and probably combine that with CJC NODAC. Now, CJC NODAC is the faster acting version, not the longer acting version.
Right.
And actually, I've seen, just going back a little bit, the best combo, because he did ask for that, right? Like the best protocol or whatever.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so the best protocol that I've seen was that, you know, steadily increasing dosage of MK along with CJC with DAC. Now, those are two long acting peptides.
Nice.
And you're basically going to be having constant pulsation of growth hormone throughout the day. I mean, MK causes, what is it? It's like 20 plus actual pulses throughout the day, and then you have CJC DAC, which is going to do exactly the same thing. So you're getting so many pulses. It's just that's really what I found to be the most effective. Now, there is going to be a decent amount of water retention, so you want to make sure that your diet's in check, your training's in check. CJC DAC wise, you know, if you can get away with doing 5 mgs total a week, it's going to be the most optimal dosage. After that, you look at desensitization issues. But a lot of people can't afford that because it's not the cheapest thing.
Right.
So I would probably, if you could, do that 2.5 mgs split 2 times a week. There really isn't any research that says you should split it. Usually people can just do one shot. But I've seen just anecdotally from at least 50 or 60 different blood work results that IGF levels and everything was actually more improved if you split the shots. And I really don't have any reason why that's happening. But yeah, I would split those, take it with something like horny goatweed, which is another somatostatin inhibitor. Again, EGCG for at least enhancing the sensitization of growth hormone receptors. And then with that, you want to make sure that you're not eating, I'd say probably 30 minutes before or after. He asked about eating as well, correct?
Yeah, he was wondering about how basically, you know, sugars, insulin levels could possibly affect these things.
Yeah, so basically any food that you eat, a lot of people will say that it's just carbs or just carbs and fats or just carbs and proteins or whatever it is. And honestly, I don't like anyone eating anything whenever they're taking their peptides. I mean, yeah. If you look at how it can just stop everything from actually working, it's not worth it. And if you're spending how much money on these peptides, I would rather have you wake up, take your peptide, you know, wait a half an hour and then eat, or have a 30-minute window before and after to at least let it go in, do its job, and be effective. So
I totally agree.
Food definitely affects that. I'm sure you know that one.
Absolutely. Yeah, like growth hormone itself, not so much, because this is, you know, exogenous true growth hormone. It's not converting into anything else, but we are relying on our system to create this, you know, once we take it. So I definitely two different things. Would you agree with that?
Completely. I'm so glad you brought that up. I just got another email earlier today about that. Someone trying to plan out their meals, and I feel bad because this guy had to have spent 20 minutes on this email because it was so intricate and it was so detailed on how he was going to take his growth hormone every 2 to 3 hours of when it peaks, so you can accelerate lipolysis, keep levels high, and peaked at the perfect timings. And he was eating like every hour he was doing something, and I was just like, first of all, I appreciate the dedication for you taking the time to send this email.
Yeah,
but you know, the exogenous hormone is so powerful. You can take it with carbs, you can take it with fats, with proteins. Yeah. It really doesn't matter. It's too powerful, especially if it's true growth hormone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's that our body, we're not turning a key like some of these peptides are, that's going to trigger our own natural production. So it doesn't matter what our blood sugar levels are and what insulin is released in our body. All that matters is that it's being put in, and it's going to do, you know, this, it's going to work regardless. I don't necessarily want to say the same thing. I do feel like I've seen in my own life that taking growth on an empty stomach for fasted cardio, and maybe it's just my own bro science, I do feel like it's helped a little bit more with fat loss versus without. But
I actually agree with that. I've seen that happen a lot. And if you actually time it, a lot of people won't do this because you do have to kind of go out of your way to wake up 2 or 3 hours earlier. But if you actually take it 2 hours before you do your fasted cardio, that's kind of right at the peak whenever fat cells and everything's going to start being released from your system and into the bloodstream. And it's a little bit easier to kind of, you know, use those as energy.
I like that idea.
Yeah, but that's the issue. Are you really going to wake up 2 hours earlier every day? A lot of people won't. Take your shower, go back to bed for 2 hours, and then you run into the issue of, is it really worth disrupting your sleep for that?
Right, right.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else that really stands out to you peptide-wise?
I mean, there's some other okay ones. I mean, if you're looking at, like, LR3, so IGF-LR3 or DES, I mean, those have their place. But a lot of people buy all of these peptides that we're talking about and do them all at the same time. And that's kind of the issue. It's if you're doing the MK and CJC with DAC, that's all you need. That's all you should be doing.
Sure.
And then if you're doing maybe, GHRP2 or GHRP6 with CJC no DAC, then maybe you could throw in, you know, LR3 or DES. Those are two good ones. I really like actually Hexarelin pre-workout. People get some pretty crazy pumps with that.
I've never specifically taken it pre-workout.
Yeah, it's pretty decent, but it's kind of on the lower end of everything else that we talked about. So it's kind of, if you're going to be spending your money, I'd rather have someone spend it on the most effective way.
Gotcha. Yeah, I do like IGF. I've had some really great experiences with LR3. But I've never experienced with the DES version. I haven't tried that personally. Do you find a preference for one over the other?
You know, I really see a lot of people respond better to LR3, to be completely honest.
Yeah, that's kind of what I've heard from people. I didn't even feel like I wanted to bother.
Yeah, well, whenever you did that, did you do the micro doses, or did you just keep it kind of at one shot or two shots?
I've always used it with growth and insulin, and I've only taken, well, not only, but I found that the best way for me to use it is pre-workout on training days.
Okay.
Yeah. What have you found?
Certain people, the majority of people, I have them do it post-workout, microdosed over the muscle train. So, I don't really have anyone doing, just chest on one day or just biceps or just triceps. So we'll kind of focus on the muscle group that if they're in prep, we're trying to keep more full.
Okay.
Or in the off season, you know, the muscle group that we're trying to grow a little bit faster. So say someone had weak biceps, because my biceps are horrible. We would have them actually microdose over both biceps, literally, maybe 8 or 12 shots per bicep head.
Okay, so this brings us to something we might not agree on then. So you obviously, you believe then that there is definitely going to be a localized growth effect from the IGF.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if I get with that. I actually tried my personal experiment. Of course, this is just one person. For an entire year, I only put it into my biceps, just only into my biceps every time I took a shot of it. And I never saw any improvement in them over anything else. Now, that's only just one person, but I've heard some people that do believe it, some people that don't. And to me, I felt that maybe it will, maybe it won't. Nonetheless, I'm not going to put it in like my glutes or, you know, something I don't want to grow.
Yeah.
Just in case. But I'm going to assume that, it's going to give me a general effect once it hits my bloodstream, that it's going to go systemic. So tell me a little bit more about your thoughts on this, because I'm open-minded, put it that way.
Well, first of all, I like that you said all that, because it really does come down to the individual. If anecdotally you don't see it, this is all in terms of what the research says, meaning it was, I'm sure you've heard of That Be True, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I've learned everything about peptides from him, and I believe he was the first one to actually come out and talk about doing this microdosing style.
Okay.
And certain people, I'll say probably the majority of people that I've seen at least responded better to it, but I've had people just like you where they did the microdosing post-workout on the muscle train, and it really didn't change anything. And you can usually tell right away in terms of how full the muscle stays.
Yeah.
But I always go with what the general amount is happening. So if I have, say I have 100 clients doing this, and 80% of them respond better to doing it microdosing, well, after that, I'm going to have everyone do it until they give me a reason not to. So if they're not responding to it, then hey, we're going to cut it out and you don't have to microdose. Because you're right, to a point, everything we use is going to go systemic. It's not just going to be localized all the time.
I think that's a good way of looking at it too. I gotta respect your take on it there.
Just trying to read the physiques that I get and interpret it my best, you know.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. What kind of dosing do you like to use? Say for post workout, when you combine all these micro doses, what would you use per day on that muscle group?
So I probably stick with around 30 to 50 micrograms. It's not a lot by any means. I mean, all of these peptides we're talking about, besides MK and CJC, you're talking about micrograms. So anyone out there that's ever tried to measure a microgram, at least on your insulin syringes, it's hard. So you're probably going to add a lot more of your whatever solvent you're using to mix your liquids in. But I'd probably stick with 30 to 50 micrograms. You really don't have to go too crazy. You can get a lot of benefits out of even 25. I've seen with a lot of people, you don't need to go with saturation dosages.
Yeah, I agree. I'd start at 25. I might work up over time. How long would you, is this something you would do every workout for a period, or how do you split up your periods of IGF use?
Okay, so this is the cool part, and this is where it gets interesting. So,
all right.
So if I had someone that did the microdosing and they responded well to it, then what we're going to do is every time we work that muscle group directly, we're going to use LR3. So say we use the bicep example. If they're only hitting bicep 2 times a week, you can almost do that indefinitely in your biceps, because you're going to have a couple of days in between both days. It's only 2 times per week. It's nothing that you're going to hit a saturation point with it. You're not going to get desensitized. I mean, you're giving your body a break. So
I like that.
Yeah, you can do that for a pretty long amount of time. Now, if you're one of my clients that did the microdosing and it didn't show any better effects, any localized growth, then I'd probably just stick with it post-workout for a couple weeks and then, possibly alter off into some other peptide. With a lot of these things, I'm a big fan of times on and times off and switching what you're using it. It just makes sense if you look at it from a common sense standpoint.
Yeah, I totally agree. Let's see, anything else we want to talk about here with peptides? I feel like you covered where I mainly would want to go, which is with MK. I feel like it's kind of showing a lot of promise. And, like you had said too, man, it's a lot easier to dose that and to take that versus having to take several shots a day in some cases.
Oh yeah. One time before bed and a lot of them are liquid. I mean, how easy is that?
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. Let's move on then. If anybody else has any more specific questions, or if this guy does about peptides, definitely come back and we'd be happy to help you. I think another thing too, one of the issues we run into with a lot of this stuff is variations in the quality, from the different sources. I know that MK is pretty expensive to purchase, on the raw powder level. It's so popular now. I haven't personally run into anything that seemed like it was underdosed or faked, but I certainly could see that happening. I've had IGF that seemed excellent, and then another batch of IGF that I could swear did nothing. So
yeah, that's a good point to touch on, and it sucks because I never like going public and saying, hey, this is who I recommend to my clients, or this is who I like. Just because I'm trying to figure out the best way to say this.
I know where you're going, but I'm going to watch you squirm and figure this one out. I know what you mean, but I don't know how to say it either quite.
Okay, so I'm not trying to shut down other competitors and just say, hey, this is the best product out there, because I haven't had everyone use everything. So if I say, hey, all my clients use this, well, there could be company B, C, and D that have just as good of products, sure, but I've never used, and then I just eliminated, 50% of their business or whatever arbitrary number you want to put on that. And I don't like they could be great people, could be a great company. I don't want to alienate anyone.
Yeah, yeah. That's a powerful podcast you have if you're shutting down 50% of their business.
That was a way too big of a
number. We shut them down. No, I totally agree. Hey, and plus, you never know, man. One place that seems excellent, we don't have control over their quality. And who's to say, we don't know the people, what they're going to be doing next month. And somebody listens to, Beast Fitness podcast, and man, episode from 2 months ago, you said that you love, X brand. And since then, that place has gone downhill. You could steer somebody to the wrong place.
So that exact situation happened to me with one of my YouTube videos, probably 8 months ago. And ever since then, I was like, I'm not talking about what I suggest, what I like. I'll just, if people want to reach out to me, maybe we'll go that route. But in general, I just keep to myself with that.
I think that's a smart move. All that being said, I will note that Advices Radio does have a sponsor that does carry peptides, and they've been in business for a long time. So that definitely says something.
Oh yeah. If you have someone with a reputation over 5 years, it's kind of hard to argue with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Advices Radio is presented by Naps Gear. Go to napsgear.org for all your bodybuilding supplement needs. While you're there, check out the entertainment section. They have blogs, video blogs, news articles, there's a Q&A, there's lab testing on many of the top products that are available on the market today that Naps carries. They have contests. There's all sorts of great stuff happening over in the Naps Gear community. So check it out today and make sure that you check with local laws before purchasing.
Let's see what else we have here. There's a bunch of questions that have been built up here. Okay, this is another interesting one. Sounds like the guy's once again a little bit on the newer side. He says that he's never competed, and he wants to know whether he should go directly from his off-season cycle into his pre-contest cycle, or if he should take a little bit of a longer break from everything and then start it up, or would blasting and cruising be a good idea? So he doesn't give us a ton of information here. kind of leads me to believe that he's definitely on the newer side to gear in general.
Yeah.
I kind of have a couple ideas. I could start this up, or you're welcome to take it if you have a couple off the bat too.
Take it away, man. All you.
All right. I would definitely personally suggest, if he is a newer guy and he's already run a decent cycle for an off season, that you give yourself a break first and take a little bit of downtime, get some blood work done, make sure that everything's back to normal. Because, you know, during our off season cycles, I feel like guys that haven't competed oftentimes kind of tend to run their doses higher just in general on the off season and try to jam as much in as they can to try to make as much progress as they can. And then once you've competed, you realize that we do tend to redline things a little bit more during the contest prep. And those of us that are more health minded, at least myself and a lot of other guys I've seen, we might dial the off season back a little bit, you know, because we know we're going to have to hit it hard during contest prep. So this guy hasn't competed yet. For all I know, he's run, you know, he's a newer guy. And for all I know, he's run 3 or 4 compounds in this previous cycle that he's just done. Regardless of how much he's run, though, you know, making sure that your health is in check is super important, because this is something that, you know, if we love doing it, we want to be responsible and make sure that we can continue doing it for a long, long time. There's no reason in my mind that a healthy person shouldn't be able to stay healthy and continue competing, even enhanced, for a long time of their lives. So my thought is, like I said, come off altogether, you know, avoid the blasting cruise, you know, at this level, at this place in your life. I don't think that that's going to be necessary. If he were, say, an HRT patient already, then sure, you know, then going back down to a cruise dose, absolutely. I've got to guess that he's not, though. So that would be my advice. And then, you know, come at it fresh. Know that you're healthy, and know that you're safe to go ahead and kind of dial things up again, because the contest prep is going to be, you know, more aggressive, and people tend to get more aggressive minded when they compete. You know, you get that taste for winning, and you know, you start out with this contest prep and you think, oh, I'm just going to keep it really light, and then 2 weeks out you see guys that are throwing in the kitchen sink doing anything they can. Yeah. You know,
anything goes during prep.
Yeah, exactly. And so you know, definitely keep in mind health here. That's my take on it. How about you though, Alex?
I'm pretty much in the same boat. First of all, I take a step back, and I'd like to have a lot of people look at the long-term picture, like you said. So not only from a health aspect, but what are you trying to do with this? Are you someone that's just going to compete one time or two times?
Perfect.
Are you someone that wants to turn pro, or, you know, be a national level competitor? Because that's really going to dictate how you at least proceed. I mean, I don't feel like anyone – I'm not a fan of PCT, to be completely honest. I feel like – if you choose to be enhanced, then that's a lifetime decision that you should make. I mean, I'm a bigger fan of the blasting and cruising method, generally having longer periods of cruising than blasting. But again, depending on the person, if you're going, the question was from off season straight into pre-contest, I would definitely have a break between that. If like you said, you're someone that's blasting pretty hard in the off season and your hormones are so high, and then if you go straight into pre-contest, you run out of room, you run out of space, you run out of time. And then at that point, after a certain time period, it's just going to be more and more of a strain on your health. The, you know, the unhealthier you are with the worst blood work means that you're going to have worse performance in the gym, means you're not going to be partitioning nutrients properly. So that means you're going to be affecting the actual muscle tissue you retain. You're going to be affecting how much fat you actually lose. I mean, you go down the line and, you know, after a certain period of time of being on, it's just going to create more of a negative feedback loop. So I would definitely take a break before your pre-contest. And like you said, I'm glad you touched on blood work. That's something that not a lot of people get done. I have all my clients that are enhanced get it every 3 to 4 months. I mean, it's something you need to do. You need to know what's going on internally, because you could feel great and you get your blood work back and you could have, you know, crazy numbers that you wouldn't have known otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. You don't necessarily feel kidney damage, you know?
Yeah, no, sadly. And I mean, you would think like a lot of these things, but usually when you feel them, it's too late.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we did an episode. There's documentary style episodes of Advice is Radio, and one of them was about steroids. We had a guy on who had kidney damage, and his kidneys will never be the same. He never felt any problems. He never felt any pain. He would have never known, other than the fact that he was getting a physical for a job. And they said, hey, something looks off here with your kidneys. Why don't you get this checked? And he looked into it further and discovered that there was some serious health issues. So it's actually stopped him. It's changed his entire life. He can't even use HRT now. So he's destroyed his testosterone levels, and he can hardly maintain anything as far as that goes. It's difficult for him to train, obviously, because of that. He's lost a ton of muscle. He has little motivation to train in the gym. And this is all due to just cycles of 1-2 cc's of Sustanon was all he ever really did.
And that's what really gets to me. Like that bothers me hearing that, because you hear those kind of stories all the time, and people spend hundreds of dollars a month on food, on supplements, on gear, on whatever. Spend the, what is it, Private Indie Labs, it's like $150. They have a male bodybuilder test. You can find codes out there.
Yep.
It's not that expensive. Go get it done, and just so you know.
Absolutely. Or, you know, if I'm lucky enough, I have a doctor that understands what I'm doing. I know not everybody is lucky enough that they have a doctor that works with them, but I do. And, you know, whether it was out of pocket or not, though, I'm going to get that stuff done, because, like I said, you know, at the beginning of this particular question, I love this sport, and I want to continue being able to do it as long as I can. And the stuff that Alex is saying and the stuff that I'm saying, these are the things that we are doing in order to continue doing it. And not only that, hardcore isn't continuing to run drugs. You know, that's what I think some people think, is like, we're just going to run it extreme like the pros, you know. But no, man, I mean, hardcore is doing everything right. That's my take on it, at least, and being as safe as possible. You make a great point, too. One of the things you said I really like is that your ability to make progress is going to be compromised if your body isn't functioning properly.
It's funny about the pro comment too, because if anyone out there actually talks with pros, or, you know, works with them, or they know anything about what actually goes on behind the scenes, the best ones are getting blood work done.
Sure.
They're getting ART done. They're doing all these things we're talking about. It's just, it's not out in the forefront. Like, you don't see many pros posting up their blood work. And that's mainly because of the affiliations with their supplement companies. They can't say certain things.
Sure.
And at least if a pro would post up their blood work, then, you know, all the comments would be, that can't be your blood work if you're taking this, this, and this. And it
right.
just can't help them in any way. But that's really what goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah. And also, too, not all the pros are running crazy doses. You know, some of them do, but I know a good handful that don't. Guys that are taking less than some non-competitors that I know.
And that's the interesting thing. Like, me and Dr. Scott Stevenson were talking about this, just the whole biological individuality of everyone, and at least how they, you know, how differently everyone metabolizes drugs. We didn't get too in depth about it, but it's definitely something I want to talk to him a little bit more, because you look at it, and like you said, you have certain people that can turn pro on 500 mgs a test and, you know, 100 mgs a trend. And right. then you have other people that they need to blast, you know, 2-3 grams to get pro. And it just depends on how well or how poorly you're metabolizing those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree, man. I think that goes for drugs in general too. You know, I mean, I can tell you firsthand that, for instance, I don't metabolize Yohimbine well. Another guy might metabolize it just fine. You know, I can take 2.5 milligrams and I'm shaking in the corner with anxiety, whereas I've worked with a bikini girl who's taken 10 to 15 milligrams of it, and, you know, she just feels good.
Yeah. I remember the first time I used too much Yohimbine pre-workout.
You never forget that day.
Yeah, never, because I'm squatting and I'm like, why do I feel so shitty? And I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
Day goes on and I think back, okay, what did I change? That was the only change. It was only, I actually didn't use any at the time, and I went straight up to 15 mgs, which was way too much for me to start off with.
Right.
Because I did that in the past, and I was fine, but apparently I've changed over time with that. And, yeah, you never forget whenever you use too much Yohimbine.
Yeah, I used to do fine with it years ago, and I could tolerate a lot more. But since time has gone on, man, it's gotten to be something I can't deal with. I can take a pre-workout, and if I didn't read the label, I'll tell you 3 hours later if it had Yohimbine in it, because I can feel it.
I hate that feeling.
Oh, it's the worst. It's like the flu and everything else.
Yeah, it really is, too, and especially, like, I like to go crazy during my workouts. That's my favorite time of the day. So yeah. If anything's impeding on that, I'm going to drop it immediately.
Yes. What pre-workouts do you like?
So lately, so no matter what my pre-workout protocol, I have a bunch of bulk ingredients, a lot from True Nutrition.
Yeah.
I do work for Performix, which is a supplement company out there.
Okay.
So I get a lot of stuff from them for free. I really like the one pre-workout Ion, but even at that, I'm not really set on anything, meaning I love the company. I know the people and I love the people behind it.
Yeah.
They've got some great products and they've got some shitty products. I'll be the first one to say that, but I'll use their pre-workout Ion because it only has like 175 mg of caffeine and I don't need that much caffeine, but it has a lot of the other goodies.
Nice.
Like, you know, beta-alanine, citrulline malate, they have ashwagandha in it. They have different nootropics, pump ingredients, endurance ingredients. So I'll use that with just my own bulk additions that I'll throw in depending on what I need for that day.
Cool. Cool.
How about you?
You know what? Because of the anxiety thing with a lot of stimulants, I just have to be careful with it. We just got sponsored over at Bodybuilding Nerds with a newer company called Gia Labs.
And, oh, nice.
Yeah, thanks. They have – what the thing I like about them is their pre-workout is it's a little bit on the milder side as far as that anxiety factor goes, but it definitely gives me what I need while I'm training. Another one, though, and now this is like the opposite of what I just said, I will use – like a half a scoop of Mesomorph by APS on my leg or back day sometimes, which
there you go.
And that has, you know, the 1,3-dimethylamine in it, which, you know, I believe it's like 65 milligrams per serving, which is just way more than I ever need. So
yeah, really
half a scoop. It does me just fine for the next, you know, 3 hours of training. How long do your workouts usually last? Speaking of,
So my workouts are usually at least 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
I'm in the gym for a long amount of time. I've always, going back to my background, just real quick so everyone doesn't misconstrue things.
Yeah. Okay.
I grew up and I was always into lacrosse and amateur boxing. So okay. If you look at those two things, practices, they were always 2 to 3 hours each. And I was doing both of those every day. Almost, you know, 5 or 6, sometimes 7 days a week. So there's 6 hours of actual output going on every day. So I really feel like it almost molded me into how I need to train now. You know, if I try training low volume, no matter how high the frequency or how high the intensity goes, I cannot grow off of that. So I've always responded very well to volume. So yeah, that's kind of why my workouts are as long as they are. They usually won't go over. That's kind of the limit, but it'll depend on prep, off season, the day, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense, man. Yeah, I'm about the same. You know, some of my workouts are a little bit shorter. You know, things like arms or shoulders, not quite as crazy. I do 2 chest workouts a week right now, so they're both a little bit more abbreviated. But then leg day is usually at least 2-3 hours, and you know, back is usually at least a couple hours too.
Yeah, and that's what everyone needs to kind of keep in context. If you're right now with my split, I basically have a base protocol where I'm hitting every muscle group in a 4-day period, so everything will get hit 2 times a week directly. But I'm actually doing full body workouts every day, so I'll have a lot of accessory work after that. So if you look at that amount of volume, it makes sense that you have a longer time period versus, like you just said, if you just have a back day or whatever, then obviously time's all going to be relative.
Right. Huh, interesting. I could probably keep sidebarring us here for the next hour.
Yeah, like I said, I could talk forever, so sorry for putting you off track.
Well, having the Q&A here was a good excuse to bring you on.
Yeah.
Let's see what else we have here. says he has a multi-part question here. Says, I'm trying to get my estrogen under control and figure out what is going on in that department. Currently on 525 milligrams of test per week, 60 milligrams of VAR per day, 40 milligrams of T-ball per day, and was running 40 milligrams of D-ball as well. So we got three orals going on here at once. I was also running 4 units of growth hormone and 25 milligrams of aromasin at every other day. However, I noticed that I started to get signs of gyno, puffy nipples, he says, and so I stopped the D-ball. He then ran Letro to clear that up, and it looks like so since all this has gone on, he had dropped that D-ball, he cleared up the estrogen with Letro, and then he went to 37.5 milligrams of aromasin every other day. He feels like that things are back under control. So his first question is, when do you think he should get his blood levels checked to see where his estrogen is now?
So first of all, unless if you're 6 weeks out from a show, you don't need to be running three orals. That's going to do that. It's so stressful on your body. I'm surprised that you even felt okay.
Yeah. And he might not, but, man, some people do that and they just feel like, well, I got to suffer, you know, I got to run this shit and run it hard. This is, you know, they get in their head that they gotta, you know, they gotta feel this pain and go through it. And they just keep pushing, you know, I think it's sometimes misinformed people do that.
Oh yeah, most definitely. And for this question with estrogen being high, it's no wonder if you're taking everything you did. I mean, you can only take so many AIs or so high of a dosage of aromasin.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you're not going to be able to work your way up to 75 mgs a day. I mean, right. That's ridiculous. You won't be able to control that estrogen. It's not going to be good for you. You're going to have joint issues with that high. I mean, it's not a good thing. So, when to get blood levels checked, usually, you know, I'd say the 3 to 4 week range, probably 4 weeks is the best time frame to at least see what's been going on. If you were running those three orals and everything like that, and you adjusted and you're feeling okay, just because you don't have the signs of gyno, just because you're not puffy, doesn't mean that your estrogen is under control. That just means that at least from a gyno standpoint, that tissue isn't being inflamed anymore. So you could still have pretty high estrogen levels that could be completely out of range. So at least the gyno stopped, but I'd probably stick to that 3 to 4 week range to actually get results back or go get blood work done rather.
Yeah, I'd stick with you there. And he also adds, says last, as for estrogen rebound goes, when I get onto PCT, do you recommend running an AI along with my Clomid, Novadex, and HCG?
So for that one, again, even though I'm not a big fan of PCT, I've still helped enough people out with PCT, because obviously, again, you're not going to see eye to eye with everybody. That I'm actually a big fan of Dave Palumbo's protocol. Obviously tweaked a little bit. So you're looking at 1,000 to 2,000 IUs of HCG every 3 days for about, you know, 7-ish shots. You want to have about 50 to 100 mgs of Clomid every day for, again, a good 3 weeks. And then you're definitely going to want to run an AI with that. I'd always prefer aromasin over aromadex just because aromadex kind of hits your lipid profile a little bit too hard. Yeah. And it's not as we'll say health conscious as aromasin is for a lot of people.
I could see that. I find for me, I find that it's good for the off season, but for somebody that doesn't have a lot of estrogen sensitivity, I see though that it to me, it seems like it's a little harder to use aromasin effectively to control estrogen. Just in my experiences, compared to Arimidex, I feel like Arimidex is more likely to get in there and get things under control without having to be quite as precise.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with that. And the one thing, I'm not a fan of Letro at all. I mean, anything that's going to completely crush your estrogen, it's not really a good thing. I mean, I know it seems like he said he had to reset, but other than that, I mean, I really don't like having people use Letro.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think we covered this one here. Let's see if we can grab a couple more quickly. All right, next question. He says, can you advise if running clenbuterol causes issues with BPH? During my cleanse cycle, I have issues urinating restricted flow, but also during the night. When I come off clenbuterol, it takes a few weeks, but the issue goes away. Alex, I'm going to have to turn to you on this one because this is something I haven't heard before. Why does clenbuterol do this to him?
So BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia. So first of all, a lot of people don't think that clen can aggravate your prostate, but it really can.
Interesting.
If you look at it from just a basic, you know, going back to kind of a common sense standpoint, remembering that clen actually depletes your taurine storages. That's what causes cramping. Okay, so I've seen a lot of people actually have cramping in a lot of their genital regions and have a lot of these issues actually arise, have it start to really flare up their prostate. And if you look at what happens is the prostate gland is underneath your bladder. Okay, when it gets bigger, it's actually going to block the flow of urine through your urethra. And if you don't get treatment for that, you can have things like bladder infections, UTIs, kidney problems. So clen most definitely can cause issues with your prostate. A lot of people I've found, they're just taking too high of a dose. You know, this is the issue where people will take, you know, just ridiculous amounts of clen, hoping that it's going to further benefit their fat loss. I'm really not a fan of high dosing clen. I'd say high dosing clen is worse than a low dose of DNP, just to paint the picture for a lot of people out there. It's one of those things where I would stick to a moderate dose. I try cutting your dosage in half, make sure you're getting enough taurine, make sure you're staying hydrated. And that usually corrects the problem with the people that I've worked with. If it doesn't go away, obviously drop it completely and you should be fine within a week or so. If it takes a few weeks for it to completely go away, then you must have had a pretty substantial dosage, or you're someone that metabolizes clen so effectively that you were using a much higher dosage than you even needed.
Yeah, that's possible, man. This is one that I hadn't been familiar with. Do you understand the mechanism as to why this is?
You know, not really. A lot of things with any of these compounds that we're talking about, they all kind of interplay, meaning, you know, testosterone, trenbolone, clenbuterol, any of these things can almost cause any issue that you can think of from a health disorder standpoint. I mean, some people can lose hair on one compound and not another. Some people will get dry joints on one compound and not another. It really is just how you respond to it and your genetic predisposition for those. So I'd really look back in your family history and see if your family has a history of prostate issues, prostate cancer, BPH, all that kind of stuff. And chances are you know, down the line, someone had that, and this just caused that to be aggravated.
Yeah, fair enough, man. That's a good answer. One more question, and we'll call it a day here. I believe, I'm going to guess this is the same guy, because it's right after this question. It's also related to prostate health. Reasons behind estrogen and prostate issues. Is there a correlation between high estrogen affecting the prostate size?
So this one's a little bit interesting, because if you are someone like we talked about, how people just go by research or they just go by anecdotal evidence, you have both sides supporting high estrogen causing prostate issues, causing prostate cancer, and then it not doing anything at all to prostate. So from a literary standpoint, it kind of makes sense if you look at estradiol. It's toxic metabolites, though. It's going to cause damage to the prostate cell's DNA, which then is going to cause further gene mutation, and then that causes an actual loss of cell growth by causing those prostate issues. So that's why, if you read any of these research papers out there, any of these physiology textbooks, that's kind of a big cause for prostate cancer, is having excessively highly elevated levels of estrogen continuously. At the same time, though, like I've said, I've read the same amount of research out there that says that there's no correlation. So to me, it goes back to the previous question, where whenever you're taking any of these exogenous hormones, it can cause just about anything to happen. To me, it makes sense that it's going to cause, you know, prostate cell DNA to be damaged and cause all these issues like prostate cancer to arise. Again, from a common sense standpoint, understanding how things work, that makes sense to me. But at the same time, you need to look at your genetics. You need to take a step back and look at why this is happening, what your estrogen levels are, because one person's high estrogen levels could be another person's low estrogen levels. So
sure.
That's kind of my opinion on it. How do you feel on this one?
Yeah, it's something that I'm not super familiar with, and that's why this is the one that we had talked about before the show.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No. That's why I'm glad to have you here, because I definitely don't know everything. It's not something that I've personally seen with myself or anybody that I've worked with, but I had heard somebody else ask this question, and I had heard a response from a doctor that that some of the medical community at this time isn't quite looking at controlling estrogen. I guess that I'm seeing that there's a possibility that this does happen, but they aren't prescribing medications to control estrogen to fix prostate problems yet.
And that makes complete sense, because from everything that I said and read, it's really inconclusive in the medical community. Unless if it's like a dead set truth or they think they can prove it, they're not going to be prescribing anything like an AI or a CIRM to help with that.
Yeah. So I think that as for now, they're just sticking with the DHT blocker route and going from there, man. But I think that, I mean, it looks like there's research that's being done. So, I mean, I'm sure that more is going to come out of this.
Yeah, it definitely has to. I mean, whenever you see at least some of the prostate issues that are arising, and especially in our physique enhancement community, where we're always getting new compounds, we're getting new things. People are trying new dosages, new everything. I would only think the prostate issues would arise. So that would tell me that people are going to start doing more and more homework, talking to more and more people, and the truth kind of has to come out one way or another. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, this has been great, man. I really appreciate you coming on. I'd love to have you back. I feel like this is only just a handful of things that we've talked about. There could be just so much more possibility, so many more things we could do together here.
I agree, man, and I really appreciate you having me on. And it was weird for me because I've only ever had people on my podcast. I've never been a guest of another podcast, so I wanted to make sure I wasn't overstepping my bounds in any way.
No, not at all, man. You're my guest. I'm happy to have you. You do what you want to do here. This is I'm sure that the listening audience is happy to hear from you too. They don't want to just hear me talk every week, you know. They want to get some other opinions. So
well, you got a pretty good radio voice, though, so I'd love to hear it all the time.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it, man. What do you got going on for the rest of your day here?
I'm sure I've missed a bunch of emails while we've done this, so I have to do that. My girlfriend came home a couple, I think maybe like 30 minutes ago, so we'll probably have dinner together. And that's pretty much it. I already watched the new episode of Walking Dead, which was, it was just like a filler episode. But
well, how can you compete with the last episode?
Oh, I know. I mean, watching everything with Glenn, that was horrible, but it was a bang to the season. Like, to actually start it off, that was crazy.
Yeah. You guys doing anything for Halloween?
Oh, my God. I forgot today was Halloween. No. man, that's a shame, because I can remember in high school, like, you know, that was a huge day because you'd get off school, you'd get to go out, you know, do things. And it completely slipped my mind.
You know, here's the deal, that you and I are working from home, and you didn't train today, as you told me. So I can imagine you didn't have any reason to be out. Now, if you were out doing a job that required you to interact with a lot of people face to face, you would have seen Halloween decorations all over the place and people dressed up, and it would have felt like Halloween. Instead, the most you've probably seen has been like that Google had like a Halloween image on their page today, you know?
You know what I was seeing, actually, and I don't know if you've been seeing this, but all day, actually all week, I've been seeing girls on Facebook and Instagram crushing pumpkins between their legs, and I couldn't figure it out. I'm like, why are they doing this? Is this like a turn on for people? Or are they just like, is it a challenge? Like, I couldn't figure it out. I guess it's because Halloween.
Wow, I haven't seen this, but you know where I'll be going. Right after we're done here, I'm going to Facebook and I'm going to do a search.
You'll enjoy the videos then.
I already got done training, so I'm about to grab. I got done with the gym, knocked out a couple emails before we got started here, but I've got a probably a good handful to get back to as well. The exciting life of a diet coach, right?
Honestly, I love it. I mean, we don't have to leave our house if we don't want to. I just literally get to adjust training and nutritional protocols every day. And like we talked before, I have some people competing this Saturday, so the peak weeks are probably the most fun of everything. So I have fun getting the progress pictures in, everyone's glucose numbers, and kind of adjusting off that, you know.
I agree. Where do you live, by the way? What state are you in?
Over in Pennsylvania.
Oh, nice. I like it over there, man. I've done some traveling through there. There's some really cool hiking that you guys have.
Yeah, like we talked about before, my brother's a big hunter, so he loves all the woods and everything out here, and I can't stand the outdoors, so.
Well, nice. Man, it's really been great to have you here. For everybody out there, if you guys want to check more of Alex out, go over to theprepcoach.com and go check out Beast Fitness Radio. You can check that out. It's on iTunes. So lots of great information. You told me about an upcoming guest that you're going to have. I'm super excited about him. I know I can't tell everybody who it is, but I'm just going to say I'm excited about that one.
So just to and I'll tell you actually after we're done recording, but we have a good two to three other people that you're going to hear, and you're probably just going to be like, oh my God, I cannot wait to hear this.
Oh,
so,
cool,
got
man.
Some cool things in the works.
All right. Well, guys, for Advices Radio, this has been Alex Kickle. I'm Scott McNally, and we are out. Thanks for listening to another episode of Advices Radio. If you're interested in advertising opportunities, please reach out to me at McNallyDiets@gmail.com or hit me up on Facebook, Scott McNally, or contact me through the Advices Radio Facebook page. Thanks.